It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. It is Striketober. Another strike today. The focus at the BCTGM, the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union. Yes, it is a mouthful. But they went on strike today against the Kellogg Corporation, a number of facilities across the country, one in Battle Creek, Michigan, one in Omaha, Nebraska, one in Memphis, Tennessee, and one in my backyard here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, just down the road a piece. And look, some 1,400 workers across the country making our cereal bits, saying, hey, we want better conditions, better wages, hours, conditions, mostly conditions. We want to hold on to what we've got. We want to make our lives a little bit better. And this is good on them. Something that has to be done in this moment. Because this is, after a year plus, year and a half of, oh, you're an essential worker, you're a frontline hero, you're the folks who bailed us out during the lockdown and stuff. Work needs to be rewarded. And I found it very interesting that the company spokesperson, this Chris Bonner, had the audacity to go, well, we're disappointed by the union's decision to strike. Yeah, of course you're disappointed. This means that they're going to finally have found a spine and said enough already. And we're seeing this wave across the country, not just with the BCTGM, but with a lot of unions. In fact, you know, right now we're waiting on the decision of what's going to happen with the IATSE workers, you know, the stagehands, all the people who bring us the magic, the folks with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, IATSE, they're some 60,000 employees and members across the country, of which, mind-blowing. And I wish democracy worked this way, because I say unions are nothing but workplace democracy. It's democratizing your workplace, giving you some bit of a voice. Having the audacity to say, I would like to have say in the conditions under which I toil and for which the wages I earn and the benefits I get, all of that stuff. Out of their almost 60,000 registered members, over 52,000 of them voted. I mean, imagine if we had a democracy, a functional democracy here in the U.S., where of the 325 million people, actually 300 million of them bothered to vote. Can you imagine? And with, in this case, 99% of them saying they're ready to authorize the first strike in the 128-year history of IATSE. This historic. And again, people go, well, they're just greedy. No. It's not about greed. It's about working conditions, as most strikes have been. And most organizing campaigns. It comes down to dignity. It comes down to respect. It comes down to working conditions. Safety. Wages are down the list, surprisingly. I know. We've been told for so long lots of things that we've been told. In fact, lots of things that corporate America tells us that just aren't so. But in this case, you've got these folks, these craftspeople, the people who are the technicians, the folks who do all the work, the people who do all the work. You get the actors come in, they do their scenes real quick, and then they're off to their trailers. The people who clean up their mess, the people who make sure their trailers are there, the people who make sure the sets are perfect, the people who make sure they put the cameras in the right spot, tear them back down, put them back again later. You know, those folks that nobody, their names are way down in the credits, if at all. Those are the folks we're talking about. The people who actually make the movie possible. Not the person who goes out in front of the camera and pretends that he's acting. The person who actually does the work. And they're saying, look, we're coming out of this pandemic and we're not going back to those 16-hour days. We're not driving home where we're falling asleep half the time and crashing into things. Done. And especially now when you're seeing all of these online platforms like Netflix or Apple TV or Amazon. They're all doing their own movies and their own TV shoots, and they're all trying to cut corners. They're all trying to cut costs. And where does that happen the most? It happens off the backs of the workers. And these workers are saying, nope. We demand guaranteed reasonable rest periods. We demand safer hours. We demand meal breaks. For sure. How dare. They demand, you know, decent wages, decent conditions, respect. And it's going to be interesting to see if this happens. I mean, the first time in its 128-year history that these folks could go on strike, which means, sorry, Netflix, Apple TV, and the rest of you, those shows may stop. So get to the bargaining table. Figure this out. I'm thrilled to see so many strikes going on because, you know, I still go back to the, in a country where you see no strikes, you see no democracy. Democracy is people marching their feet in the streets. All of them. So good on them. Today, President Biden was in Michigan. I find it interesting. Michigan, heart of the center, because Battle Creek, Michigan's where Kellogg is headquartered. But the president was in Michigan, Howell, Michigan, to be exact, where he was pushing his Build Back Better plan. He said, look, as a nation, we're at risk of losing our edge. And this is something I've been saying for, well, all 16 years of doing this radio program. That if we don't make things, if we don't build things, if we don't manufacture, if we don't have the brain capital, if we don't have the human capital to be able to take a chunk of something and turn it into something that has more value, we are going to continue to fall behind. If we can't create our own steel and turn it into whatever we need, we have a major national security risk. If we can't build the things that we need to exist and to survive, think of the last 18 months, then we're going to have real problems. And this administration has realized this. And look, as I understand, going back to during the Obama years even, when President Biden was Vice President Biden, he was calling for this stuff back then. Stuff that I, too, was calling for during the Obama years because it's never changed. It's what we need. It's what the country needs to move forward. So today he gave the speech and did as we've been talking about the last couple of days. Got to get out of the stump and start embarrassing people. You got to start calling out names. You got to start selling what's in this Build Back Better plan. You got to do it. He said, look, our infrastructure's crumbling. We're losing our edge. We're losing our edge in education and manufacturing. And he's saying, look, we want to spend this investment to make us more competitive globally. This is an investment in the future. And I've been saying, look, it's something of a reset of the last 40 years to give the working class of this country a leg up and to maybe, I don't know, help them support their families a little bit. But he said, look, we're the largest economy in the world. We still have the most productive workers and the most innovative minds in the world, but we are at risk of losing our edge. And I don't disagree on any level. If we don't spend big, if we don't invest big in getting the things we need, the roads, the bridges, all the broadband access. I mean, it's ridiculous, the cell phone reception that I get. And I talk to people all over this area and they say the same thing. It's terrible. The infrastructure's terrible. And in an environment where e-commerce is the future, or at least that's what we're told, how is it that you can live in a semi-rural area and get squat? So these investments are going to help us be more competitive, going to make our lives a little bit better, going to help create millions of new jobs, and it's going to help people. I mean, for me, that's the end of this road. And I was talking with someone today, and I said, and they can't figure it out. This person was a Republican voter, not a Trump voter per se, but a Republican voter. So a little older school mentality, not as crazy. But he's going, I don't understand. This is good for the country. It's something we've needed for decades. How come we can't get this done? And I said a couple of things. First, I do believe that the Republicans are dug in, that they're not going to give Biden and the Democrats any win. They're playing the 2022 game. This is all politics. They're going to stop any progress and continue to make us fall further and further behind because it's in their political interests for nothing to get done. Just like, you know, in a couple of years down the road, if Republicans take control again, it will be in the political interests of Democrats to not get anything done. The difference, and this is the difference, had Donald Trump in 2017 come out with a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, I guarantee you Democrats would have gone for it. I guarantee you Democrats would have voted to move that along. And you go, well, how can you know that? Well, when Trump came out with his first COVID plan, if you remember, the first bit of money coming out to people, Democrats voted for. They weren't on the scorched earth bandwagon. They weren't on the, oh, we're going to make him look bad. They were on the, hey, how can we make people's lives better? How can we do the right thing? And this is the difference. This is the difference of the mentality between the two parties. I hear people tell me all the time, but Rick, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, they're all the same. No, they're not all the same. The Republicans will burn your house down. And they'll tell you they're going to burn your house down. And then when you try to put it out, they're going to push you in the house. Because that's the mentality. If they, like a two-year-old in the cereal aisle, kicking and screaming because they want the toy. If they don't get it, they will destroy everything. And this is what we're seeing. You look at this budget reconciliation that they want the Democrats to have to take all of the debt ceiling through. Understand, we went through a drunken spending era during the Trump years. $7.8 trillion Donald Trump spent. $7.8 trillion. They basically went for the best lobster dinner with champagne you could possibly find anywhere. They gorged themselves on the best of the best. Filet mignon, Dom Perignon, you name it, they had it. Stuffed it in doggy bags, gave it to the actual dog, threw it out in the back, whatever they could do. And now they're trying to skip out on the check. And they're not even trying to hide it. They're coming right out and saying, no, we're going to hold the world hostage because we don't want to pay our own bills. Because we know over the administrations, the Republican administrations spend much more frequently and in much bigger numbers and much deeper debt than the Democrats do. Because Democrats always fall into this idiocy of we got to be somewhat responsible. You know, we can't be seen as tax and spend liberals. No. We've got to be responsible because we got to think about, you know, this or that. Or where Republicans are like, what, we got the credit card? Party time! You know, it's weekend at Bernie's. And there's nothing that they won't spend on except for things that help actual people. Money for the wealthy? Done. Going to overspend on military stuff? Absolutely. Feed a hungry child? Oh, no. Pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Now, granted, they don't have bootstraps, but maybe they can pull anyway. Just hope they're a boy. It's crazy where we are. And you got Mitch McConnell right now, you know, dug in. They're you got Mitt Romney, who's saying, dug in. Going to filibuster any debt increase. And you go, where were you before you spend the money? Where were you during the $7.8 trillion drunken spending spree of the last administration? Oh, that's right. You were complicit. And now that it's politically expedient, and understand what this is. This whole debt ceiling debacle is about making sure we don't get the infrastructure investments that we need. This is about gumming up the system. This is about tying the Democrats in knots so that they can't move forward on the Build Back Better plan. And really what they hope is that the Democrats will shoot themselves in the foot and not get the bipartisan bill either. So that we're going to go another 10 years without investing in the future of this country. That we're going to leave another 10 years down the road where our kids are going to be further behind than the rest of the world. But at least the Republicans will have won the battle. While the rest of us end up with what we get. Crummy cell phone reception, bad internet, roads where we've got to get the front end aligned half the time, no public transit to speak of, climate change another decade worse, and well, forget about it by then. All the things that are in this, gone. And I'm not even talking about the human stuff. I'm not even talking about the early childhood education stuff that's going to make our kids a little more competitive. The technical, the free community college and technical school stuff that I'm hoping can get passed that'll make our kids much more competitive as they enter the workforce. No, none of that. I'm not even talking about the chompers and the glasses and the hearing aids for granny. No, I'm not even talking about that stuff. Or family leave that's going to help people take care of an aging parent or a sick loved one. Or, paid leave that you can take care of a child that you bring into the world. No, why should we do that? Why should we be like the rest of the industrialized world? We should be like we are, broke and angry and living under an austerity kind of mindset. But at least the Republicans will have won. And Democrats will give in because they don't want to burn the house down. Because they're not crazy. And Republicans know that, which is why when Dick Cheney was asked, will the Democrats cave? He goes, yeah, it's what they do. Because the one with compassion loses. Anybody knows the person who cares least in any relationship is the one with all the power. Because they're willing to burn everything down. They're willing to trash the entire relationship. So in this environment, the Democrats are clearly the ones who care more about this country because they're not willing to burn things down. They're not willing to take food out of the mouths of children. They're not willing to want to see veterans homeless on the street. But that doesn't matter because the narrative, the election was stolen from Donald Trump. I still see people driving around with, Trump won signs. And you go, really? And while we're arguing over dollars and cents on the Democratic side, the Republicans are literally eating the lunch. We desperately need investment. Desperately. We desperately need to leave a legacy for our children and our grandchildren. You think of all the things that came out of the New Deal era. That generation, the greatest generation, got it. That they needed to make their lives better. They needed to do what they needed to do to rise to that moment, to make things better. But also to leave things for their children and their grandchildren, and even their great-grandchildren. Because that's how much they did. And it's how little we've done. Which is why desperately we need the investment. So good on Joe Biden. Good on him for getting out, and I hope there's going to be more of this shaming because we desperately, desperately need it. I got lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to take a quick break, right back with Carl Rosen, the president of UE, right back after this. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day Henry George accepted the nomination to run for mayor of New York on the United Labor Party ticket. In cities across the country, trade unionists met to found state labor parties and to hammer out political platforms for local and state elections. In New York City, ULP advocates issued the Clarendon Hall platform and nominated Henry George as the ULP candidate for the mayoral race. George had gained prominence with the 1879 publishing of his book, Progress and Poverty. In it, he addressed private land ownership as the basis for inequality and advocated for a single tax system. At New York's Cooper Union that evening, where thousands of supporters gathered, George addressed the crowd. He presented the ULP platform of higher wages, shorter hours, better working conditions, government ownership of railroads and communications, and the end to police repression. Burroughs and Wallace described the scene that night in their book, Gotham, A History of New York City, to 1898. During his speech, George declared, quote, "This government of New York City, our whole political system is rotten to the core." He argued that politicians had made a trade out of assembling votes and selling them to powerful interests. What business got in return was police protection, lax enforcement of housing and health codes, friendly judges, and fat franchises. To purify the political order, working class voters had to sever ties to all the established parties and choose from their own ranks. For a party that had just been founded weeks before, George came in second. But like its sister organization in Chicago, the New York ULP would split over issues of socialism within a year.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Here at The Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor, and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can. And help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, we need, desperately need, massive investment for the future. Our children need it, but we need it too. I mean, at the end of the day, the jobs that will be created, the reverberation effect across economies, and we can get into all that wonky stuff, that how it's going to be good for the economy, it's going to be good for workers, it's going to be good for people, and it's what we need. And this is what I'm hoping Biden will be doing in the coming weeks. Get out on the stump like he was today, hammering on the fact that we need it, and telling stories of how it's going to make people's lives better. Tell those stories. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what we need to be doing as the Democrats are arguing over numbers. Is it $6 trillion? Is it $3.5 trillion? Is it 1.5? Is it 2? I don't even know where we are on the scorecard, but I've asked Carl Rosen to come talk with us. He's the general president of UE United Electrical, their website, ueunion.org. Carl, thanks for taking some time for us.
Great to be here, Rick. Happy to join you and your listeners.
So I'm looking at this, you know, Democrats are in this fight over numbers. Is it going to be 6, 3.5, 1, 2, 5? Who knows? And we're not talking about what's in this bill that's going to make people's lives better.
No, that's right. And I think that's something that members of the Progressive Caucus have been doing very well, is saying, let's talk about the issues that are here. Well, let's talk about expanding Medicare so that it covers hearing and dental and eye care and gets to a lower age and brings down the cost of prescription medicines. Let's talk about providing quality childcare for everyone in this country, so folks who want to work can work, and so that kids all get an equal start in life. Let's talk about making sure that there's care there for our seniors. Let's talk about making sure that there is a planet here for us where we can live, by starting to make the investments, and only a down payment, but at least start to make the investments that are needed to deal with climate change, either to protect areas that are under threat because of climate change, or to start making the conversions that are needed and put people to work at good wages, union jobs, doing the work that's needed to have non-polluting industries instead of polluting industries, yep, whether it's an energy field or any other area that makes use of carbon-based products. Nope. So there's a tremendous amount in here that's all extremely important. But what's most important about it is it's from the bottom up. This is not trickle-down economics. That's why the right wing is so upset about this. That's why the corporate sponsors are so upset about this. This is starting it from the bottom up rather than the other way around.
No, and that is the important part. And I've been saying it's a reset of the last 40 years. It's undoing Reaganomics, the supply side voodoo Reaganomics that have really put us in this place. And I've had people tell me, well, you know, we were missold this. It was that it was going to trickle down. We were scammed. And I'm going, we weren't scammed. Trickle down worked exactly the way it was supposed to. That's the money, right. Goes to the people at the top, and the rest of us are looking up waiting for something that is never going to come. You knew it 40 years ago just as well as we knew it now.
That's exactly right. Follow the money, and we need to follow the money to the right places this time. There's a tremendous amount of money in this country that can easily cover the reconciliation bill and a lot more. I mean, the original figure was a lot better, the six trillion they were talking about. We should have done it. The three and a half trillion was already a compromise on that, and now they're wanting to chop it down further or not at all. I mean, just an outrage.
No, it's absolutely crazy. And you look at this, and good on you guys for standing up and telling the Progressive Caucus to stand firm. I know there's some, and look, I'm somebody who says we got to take what we can get when we can get it, but you still got to fight for what you want before you get what you can. So I'm of the mindset you go, hey, we should be pushing for more, and good on them for doing it.
That's right. And there are also many other important elements that have been stripped out of this bill too, that ought to be there. And you know, let's remember, we're only in this situation because the U.S. Senate is allowed to function as an anti-democracy institution where it requires 60 votes to get something passed under normal conditions. And that's there, you know, I mean, that traces back to the history of slavery. We know that. And that's there to keep from the American people from being able to get what they support in overwhelming numbers. And people in the U.S. in overwhelming numbers support everything that's in this reconciliation bill. And it's only because we have this cockamamie filibuster combined with an unelected parliamentarian who can declare certain things out of the bill on arcane rules and it's all a shell game. They can get that, you know, they've got all kinds of ways to get around that parliamentarian if they really want to. It's giving people political cover as to why things aren't included.
No, and this is one of those moments, Carl, and the reality is, and you hit it right on the head. The stuff in this bill, when you start talking to people about what's actually in it and getting away from the number fighting, overwhelmingly Americans want expanded Medicare for people, you know, 55 and older. They want expanded Medicare for granny to get some new chompers and a hearing aid and some vision work, because we know it leads to better health outcomes. I mean, we can make those wonky arguments, but the reality is it's just making people's lives better. And for me, that's the point that should be hammered home again and again.
That's right. And it's good policy. And then it's also good politics. And this is the problem that the Democrats keep running into. They get into office and they don't deliver. I mean, the Republicans, when they get into office, they not only deliver what they ran on, they do eight times as much damage than what they had threatened to do. And they really deliver for their corporate masters. Well, you know, if the Democrats want to pretend that they're a party of working people in this country, of the dispossessed in this country, then they actually need to deliver for us instead of coming in and coming up with excuses why they aren't delivering. Yeah. And that's what we're watching right now. And that's got to change.
So what do you say to the person, Carl, who goes, well, if the Progressive Caucus does stand up, if they are the ones who are going to push and push, that we may end up with nothing at the end? I predicted months ago that eventually we'll probably get nothing because everyone's going to shoot each other in the foot. And it'll be another decade before we start talking about these kind of investments again. What do you say that, you know, taking that hard line could lead to nothing on the other end?
Negotiations is never easy. And it's always darkest before the dawn. So you have to be prepared to go toe to toe or you will end up with nothing. And we have to continue this fight. And here's the problem. They could pass this infrastructure bill, but if they don't pass a reconciliation bill, we're going to end up with worse than nothing because the Democrats are going to lose in a landslide next year. And then Katie bar the door on what else is going to happen to us. They already control the Supreme Court. We've got the evil one waiting to try to come back in 2 years. And if they steal enough votes in all of these other states, it's a real threat that we could be in a dark ages kind of situation here. The way to stave that off is to deliver for the American people. And if it takes the Progressive Caucus to slap other parts of the Democratic Party upside the head to say, wake up, you got to do something here or we're all going to be toast, not to mention what it's going to do to this country, then more power to them. That's what we're saying. When we're in bargaining, we don't tell our members, right before the contract's done, let's agree to half a loaf right now. No, you keep fighting for everything you can get right until the end. Will there be compromises? Sure. But if they pass the infrastructure bill right now without any deal on the reconciliation bill, the reconciliation bill will never come.
Absolutely.
It's gone. That's why they have to stand tough.
No, that's the only leverage that's left. So they have to be linked. There's no way you go with one because you're not going to get the other. And look, this is where I've been saying for a very long time, and I've been a union guy over 30 years. I've been part of these negotiations. You understand the give and take. I don't think the Democratic Party understands how to negotiate, which is why we need people who do, which is why we should have people like you on those negotiating committees.
Well, and frankly, you know, the folks in the Progressive Caucus, a lot of them have close ties to labor and understand how it's done. And that's why they're doing it. Shame on some parts of labor that don't recognize what a gift this is to the working class and don't find more ways to take advantage of it. But, you know, there's plenty of unions that do understand it and are working with them closely and are glad to see that this type of approach is being used. It's what's needed.
Yeah, is this a moment for labor to step forward and start talking about this Build Back Better plan and really the bipartisan infrastructure plan? Because we do need both of them, and I think we need to do that educating of what each one is and why each one is important.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and frankly, it should have all been one bill, and that was the original plan. And it all encompasses basically Biden's agenda. Labor spent a tremendous amount, both in money and people effort, to get him elected, with this as his agenda. And in order to try to deal with the quote unquote moderates, who are basically corporate Democrats, let's call them what they are, a deal was cut to split the bills. But still move them both. And it was a face-saving thing, I guess, et cetera. But there was a deal there that they're now trying to get out of on the other side, and it's not right. So, all of the labor movement should be standing up for both bills. Both of these are important together, including in the reconciliation bill are pieces of the PRO Act. I mean, it's just nuts for labor not to go to the barricades for that.
No, and it's what we need. Now, not everything in there, but the financial parts of it. And let me ask you about that since you brought it up. It's not everything I want. I want a full repeal of Taft-Hartley. I want to return my Wagner rights back to me. And we can argue if that's even enough. But, the financial part of it is a little bit of a disincentive for employers to keep breaking the law. We just found out that Amazon was illegally fired two workers there, and they reached some kind of an agreement and gave them back pay and slapped them. Amazon got the slap on the wrist, posted the dreaded notice. But that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they see it as a... The fines are so small, or there aren't fines, that the back pay awards or whatever else are so small for these corporations. They just see it as a cost of doing business, right? It's not something that's going to stop them from doing business the way they want. It's just something that they build into their expectations of how they're going to operate their business. We need something that hits them a lot harder. What's in the reconciliation bill begins to do some of that.
Does it? I mean, look at Amazon. Amazon spent $200 million keeping 5,000 workers in Bessemer, Alabama, from exercising their right to join and form a union. Harassed, intimidated, conned the cops, bought a postal service guy, did everything you could possibly do. And we're still deciding if maybe the penalty should be we run another election. If it's me, I think the law should be you impose a union, you impose a first contract, and you shove it down their throats. But that's just me.
Well, it's not just you. There's a whole bunch of us who think that way. And I'm glad that you're putting it out there, because that's what's going to need to happen in order to turn around the reign of terror that these corporations run during elections right now, union elections.
So let me ask you this, because we're seeing right now all across this country, at least in my lifetime, this is the most strike activity that I have seen here tonight. You have, members of the BCTGM in Michigan, in Nebraska, here in Pennsylvania, in Memphis, Tennessee, 1,400 workers at Kellogg's on strike. You saw the vote that came out yesterday. IATSE, 98% of their members authorizing the first possible first strike in their 128-year history. We've seen a lot of this stuff going on. And I've been saying, look, it's Striketober. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. And, whether all of these will end up with people on the picket line versus some of them, most of them probably will get settled, which is usually what happens. But the fact that the threat is being made, the fact that these votes are coming in such overwhelming numbers and huge participation, my hat's off to IATSE with the, you know, their folks are spread all over the country, and for them to get, you know, a huge
90%
turnout and then well over 90, you know, like 98% in favor. I mean, that's just great. And, you know, but it sends such a strong message to the employers that gets the employers to think, hey, maybe we got to do something. But this isn't happening in a vacuum. This is happening because workers are fed up, and they've been fed up for a long time, but they're now seeing an opportunity. And, you know, the pandemic has made things worse for workers, but it's also liberated workers to a certain extent that they've said, hell no, I'm not going to keep doing a crappy job for low pay, and also putting my health and my family's health at risk, maybe my life at risk. And we're not gonna stand for it anymore. So this is great that this is happening. I would say, you know, I mean, you look back a couple of years and you had all of the teacher strikes, right? And they kind of caught one happened, and then it led to the others, et cetera. We're in a little bit of a similar circumstance, but now it's over in different sectors of the economy, yeah. Sectors that really have been on their back for a long time in terms of real fight back. I mean, manufacturing has been very tough to do organizing in. And very tough to get workers to go out on strike because they've been afraid they'll get replaced, you know, and that other jobs that are out there are no good either. And, you know, one of the things that helps is, frankly, the whole fight for 15 has actually resulted in lifting up wages in a lot of places. And, you know, why work at a crappy job that's, you know, putting your health at risk when you can go get another job that's maybe less stress and less wear and, you know, pretty close to the same wages, and none of them have any decent benefits anymore. I mean, you know, there's no reason to stay there.
Yeah. No, and this is one of these things I've been saying, you know, we're seeing the organized workers, you know, taking this moment, seizing this moment for better wages, hours, conditions, dignity, respect, all of that stuff. But the sad reality is you've only got about 6% of the private sector workforce that are in unions. That means the rest of the workforce is getting hammered to death, and they're not able to go out and strike like this, which is why I'm a big fan of, we need to get something done through the PRO Act. We need to get something done to make it easier for those 94% of workers to have the same rights, the same power, the same ability as their union brothers and sisters.
Absolutely. But also, even in non-union workplaces, workers are standing up and fighting back. They won concessions during the pandemic, health and safety things. You saw it in a lot of places. You know, we've got a project called the Emergency Workplace, the Emergency Worker Organizing Committee, EWOC, that we started jointly with DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, and UE put it together, where there are literally hundreds of volunteers from all kinds of union backgrounds, not just ours, many others too, who will talk workers through with how do you fight back, how do you win immediate gains, and how do you maybe also turn it into a union organizing drive. And so people should reach out and take advantage of that. And it's happening all across the country. And it's part of the big upsurge.
No, it's most certainly something we absolutely need to be doing more of. Workers talking to workers and raising conditions for everyone. And when in a couple of weeks, I'd love to have you back and talk about that and how we can get more people joining and informing and fighting this. Because at the end of the day, the only way we get a working class as prosperous as the ones of my grandparents' generation left us is if you're taken to these picket lines. But Carl, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing your thoughts. Good on you, brother.
Thank you much. Great being here. Hope to see you again soon.
You as well. Carl Rosen, General President of the UE, the United Electrical. Make sure you check out their website. UEunion.org is that site. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1945. That was a day known in Hollywood as Black Friday. After World War II, the movie industry began to rake in profits. But they did not pass those profits along to their employees. 10,000 members of the Conference of Studio Unions were on strike. They were part of the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. They were also in a jurisdictional battle with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, or IATSE, over who should represent stage decorators. The strike
wore on for half a year. The studios had more than 100 films backlogged and were able to wait out the strikers. But as the strike continued and the studios remained silent, pressure mounted. Despite the tensions between the two unions, thousands of IATSE members refused to cross the picket lines. On Black Friday, the strikers decided to concentrate their efforts at the Warner Brothers Studios gate. 300 picketers gathered to hold the line. Scabs, hired by Warner Brothers, tried to drive through the workers' picket lines to the studio. Variety accounted what happened next, writing, quote, "Strikers deployed from their barricades, halted non-strikers, and rolled three automobiles on their sides. By noon, reinforcements arrived from both sides. Firemen were called in to turn their hoses on the striking workers. Warner Brothers security deployed tear gas. Common for the time, accusations were hurled that the Conference of Studio Union Strikers were communists. As a result of the strike, the Conference of Studio Union's employees were assigned to other jobs in the studios. When they refused, they were locked out. The union never recovered. The violence at the Warner Brothers Studios gate also helped to fuel the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act through Congress, which eroded union protections. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So, some trade deficit numbers. Uh-oh, trouble. Evidently, our trade deficit in August up to $73.3 billion. That's a 1.4% increase above July of 70.3. And we're back on track. Record deficits. Yay! Evidently, the pandemic is changing, and our appetite for foreign-made goods, well, rising. And this, is, again, brings me back to what Joe Biden was talking about today. We're losing our competitive advantage, we're losing our edge, and we've got to reshore manufacturing. We've got to build the things of the future that we need, and we need to do it. Well, we need to do it right here. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we get to do some of that, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, to come share some thoughts on, well, what the president had to say today and what the trade advisor had to say on Monday. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Ricky, it is good to be with you, even though there was bad news about the trade deficit, of course.
Yeah, I mean, this is another one of those moments where you go, Houston, we got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, here's what I struggle with is that, you know, the lesson of the pandemic was that being overly reliant on imports is a stupid strategy from a public health perspective, from a national security perspective, from an economic perspective. And there were all these earnest efforts, you know, from political figures and from the business community say, we're going to get this right. We're never going to, you know, be put in this situation again. Yet here we are 18 months later, and the situation is that the trade deficit is growing. And just in case your listeners don't know what that is, that's the difference between the volume of exports that we're sending out of the United States to other countries and the volume of imports that we're taking in from other countries, mostly China. And we've been running trade deficits for a very long time, but there can be a strategy to bring that down. It starts with reshoring some of that manufacturing, what Joe Biden has been talking about. And it also has to do with a trade policy that places a price on things that currently priced, like the pollution that occurs in these overseas factories when they're making all this cheap disposable stuff that people love to buy here. You know, we don't have to pay any of the direct cost for the pollution that's being created. We will down the road, Rick, but that's not reflected in the price of the good. It should be. Or if they're made with exploited labor or under other sorts of conditions. And so what does this mean at the end of the day? Because people do like to get cheap stuff. It's like, you know, from a consumer perspective, just take a minute to think about your purchase, and why not buy something more durable that's going to last for 10 years, even if it's going to cost you 10% more.
Yep.
When you're purchasing it. And from a societal perspective, think about the cost when we lose these factory jobs. I am sure there is not a person out there who hasn't lived in a community or known someone who has lost their job in manufacturing, who has seen what happens to a community. It is hard for that community to recover. You know, and it may get jobs back, it may bring the unemployment rate down, but those are not going to be well-paying, family-supporting jobs. And it spirals that community or the neighborhood into poverty or near poverty conditions for a lot of folks. And it takes a generation or two to recover from that. And so this stuff is easy to lose. It's hard to get back. We can get it back. We've seen great examples recently where companies have said, hey, we're going to build a battery factory, or like Ford, you know, create 10,000 jobs. But we got to do more of that. We have to make it intentional. And hopefully that's yet another signal that we need to change the way that we're doing things.
No, I'm right there with you. But you, when you said, you know, people like cheap goods, I'm going, well, I don't. I want good goods. I want something that's going to last. Cheap is relative. If I buy it and it breaks and I got to go buy another one, it wasn't cheap. So for me, I want quality goods. And this is where, you know, I come back to, you know, American-made stuff I'd put up against anything in the world, especially the cheap junk we're getting from China, which, you know, I got to be honest, is, you know, the quality is just not there. It's never going to be there because they use the cheapest possible yeah. things into it. So for me, it's just it's like, how do we get here? Because I've said this before. I would love to every shelf have a Chinese option and an American option. I will pick the American-made product every single time. The problem is those options don't exist, Scott.
Yeah, there's not as many of them. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the trade ambassador, as you mentioned, Catherine Tai is her name. She is great. She's fantastic. She's really, really bright. She listens to the concerns of working people. She gave a speech on Monday that outlined the administration's China trade policy for the first time. And this is something that a lot of people wait for. And Rick, to your specific point, she went back and she said, how did we get here? Here's how we got here. Basically, we gave the store away to China. You know, there's this theory that if we traded more, we'd get more democracy, we'd get more consumers in China buying our stuff. Guess what? That hadn't happened. And we get peace, too.
Right, but let me ask you, did you actually believe that when they told you that?
I did not believe that. In fact, I still have a sign that I'll pull out the next time I'm on that says no blank check for China, way back from 2001. But that was the prevailing wisdom. That was the mainstream wisdom. A lot of national Democrats thought that at the time and were willing to give that theory a chance. Obviously, 20 years later, that's turned out to be bunk. It has not worked. And now we're stuck with a policy that is really dug in. And for people saying, well, we want change now. Look, it's going to be hard. There is no easy way to untangle this. If there were an easy way to untangle it, it would have been done a long time ago. Trump couldn't do it. He tried to use a sledgehammer. That didn't work. And then he tried to make a deal with China. That didn't work. Obama tried to use diplomacy. Bush, you know, hid his eyes from the problem. And Clinton just thought everything was great, you know, when he did this. And so we've had a history of more than 20 years where we haven't got this right. So it's going to take a change in course. It's going to take a strategy. And this is what Ambassador Tai talked about. I'm encouraged by it.
I'm encouraged, too. Without question, I'm encouraged by it because, you know, it's like anything. You first have to know you have a problem. And you and I have known there's been a problem for a long time. Our elected leaders, yeah. sadly, have not.
Yeah, right. And that has changed. And I think that, you know, one thing that we've said about Donald Trump, we both said this, that at least he understood there was a problem with trade policy. He may have not approached it from a perfect perspective, far from perfect, but he understood that there was a problem. And Biden also understands that and has been educable on this and has put people in positions to do things about it who also get it. And he listens to people like Senator Sherrod Brown, who's gotten this for a long time, or you know, the United Steelworkers Union, who's gotten this for a long time, or the Teamsters, who have gotten this for a long time. And so there's a different set of people sitting around the table than there normally are when these policies are being written. Normally, it's these investment bankers and lobbyists for big companies that are writing the trade policy. And so this is a more worker-centered policy. I am sure that there will be points that we disagree with along the way, but what Catherine Tai said on Monday was so true. She outlined how we got here on steel and what the problems are with China and steel, and also with semiconductors, and also with solar panels, and did it in I think a very credible way. And, you know, Joe Biden talked about a lot of these same issues about trying to bring manufacturing back, having it made in America, making these smart investments. And so it's like a 1-2 punch. Yes, we need a good trade policy, but we also have to get our act together here at home. And that's what the Build Back Better plan and the infrastructure bill are all about.
Yeah, and what's the point of investing in the country if you're not producing the things that you need to invest in, and someone else is getting rich off of your investment? It just seems silly to me. But one of the things I did find interesting is this idea of pushing domestic content. I've been saying for years, domestic production for domestic consumption. We should be producing what we need here at home. We have our own supply chains, that we're self-sufficient. This idea that we're spread out all over the world, dependent on countries that clearly do not like us. And I'm sure you noticed this week the Chinese sent 52 jet fighters over to Taiwan.
Oh, yeah.
That was a clear message that they are not happy with our discussions about trade.
Yeah. I mean, look, China makes 60% of the world's steel. China makes a majority of the world's lithium ion batteries. China makes a ton of semiconductors too. We're behind on all of that, by the way. And so it does make sense to untangle this. And to your point, Rick, you got to do that through policy. And one of the ways is procurement and domestic content. That is, when the government is purchasing something or is giving money to states and localities to do infrastructure, those materials should be made in America. So when we're laying out broadband for communities, that fiber optic cable should be made in America. When we're building new bridges, that structural steel should be made in America. When we're erecting new wind towers and putting in new solar panel installations, those should also be made in America. And there's a couple of ways to do that. One is the direct government purchases, and Biden has an executive order on that, on what's called Buy American. That's well underway. The other is this highway funding, the infrastructure funding. There's 60 pages of new domestic content rules that would strengthen, modernize these requirements if we get that bipartisan bill passed along with the Build Back Better plan. And then as part of Build Back Better and some of these other proposals, and I think this is what encourages me, is that the clean energy economy that we want to build, there will also be tax incentives to have that made in America as well.
Yeah.
So that there's more of an incentive to do the investment if the materials for the wind turbines, for the solar panels are made in America. And electric cars, here's a great example, that if you're a consumer buying an electric car, you're going to get an even better tax incentive if you're buying an electric car that A, is made in America, and B, it's made with union labor. And I think that's awesome. I think that's where policy should be headed. We just got to get all of this across the finish line now.
No, but what do you say to the person then, Scott? Because, you know, you and I have talked about this in subsidizing companies to build things here at home. What do you say to the person who says, well, that's what China's doing. They're subsidizing companies. They're giving them tax incentives, only they're doing it in a more direct way.
Yeah. So there's two big differences. Number one, China runs exclusive programs. They subsidize their national champions at the expense of everybody else. And in the case of steel, the Chinese government owns these companies. So this is not about the federal government owning any company. And this is also not about the federal government putting in subsidies so that we can be exporting this stuff to China and other countries. This is to take care of our own needs. China has what we call excess capacity, and they use these subsidies so that the Chinese producers can ship their excess steel abroad, they can ship their excess solar panels abroad, they can ship their batteries abroad. And so that's the major difference with all of this. We've had an industrial policy in the United States since the time of the Washington administration. It's taken different forms, but we've had it. And this idea that you can't do it is one of these ideological right-wing things where it's like, oh, multinational corporations know best, leave them alone. Well, that has bought us shortages, supply chain disruptions, and a total reliance on China for key materials and products. It was a dumb strategy from an economic perspective, from a national security perspective, from a public health perspective, and from a clean energy future perspective. And I'm glad the Biden administration recognized this. I'm glad a lot of Democrats in the Congress recognize this. And I'm glad even some Republicans in the Congress recognize this as well.
No, it's something we most certainly need. And look, we need to protect our steel industry. I mean, you guys just had a forum recently with a couple of congressmen, Congressman Lamb here from Pennsylvania and others, you know, talking about, hey, how do we save our steel? Because everything comes back to steel. And one of the things that that came out of your presentation was the amount of steel that we make compared to what China makes. And it was some just incredible number that basically the amount of waste that China has is what we produce almost.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is I'm going to throw some stats out there, but the United States more or less makes about 100 million metric tons of steel a year, a little less than that. The global excess capacity, that is, there's more steel mills than there is demand in a normal year, is between 600 and 700 million metric tons a year. In China alone, that figure is 300 to 400 million metric tons. So China has zombie steel mills. These are steel mills that are making steel for absolutely no one. They have three of those for every one of our mills that is actually making steel that people, you know, need and buy, customers like the big three automotive companies or folks who make washing machines and other things in the United States. And so it is a crazy big problem. And that's why we have tariffs on imported steel, and not only steel from China, but also steel from Europe, because what happens in China has impacted the way that the Europeans run their steel business, the way other countries, other continents run their steel businesses as well. And this all has an impact on the United States, because we have the most open market in the world. And so that's why we have the tariffs. That's why we have to have these difficult conversations with our allies to say, look, we need a steel industry. Some of these companies have been on the brink for a very long time. You got to cut us a break here. We do not want to be dependent on China. And at the end of the day, that's not good for you either. So they're going to work out a solution here. But that's why we have steel tariffs on. It's not because of some, you know, just some Trump fantasy or what have you. This has been a problem for a long time, and this Biden administration recognizes it to be a problem as well.
No, it's something we absolutely have to address. And as we talk about this all the time, if you're going to have a functional country, if you're going to be a first world country, steel is like the most important thing, especially for national security purposes. So the fact that we're going to protect our steel industry, for me, is just, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. I mean, it's in all the stuff that I mentioned, the yep. electric vehicles, the solar panels, the wind turbines. Not only that, Rick, because of the way steel is made, there is carbon used in it, but American steelmakers are committed to decarbonize, and they're going to be far ahead of China. And so if you shut down an American steel mill and are depending on China for your steel, we're going to run backwards.
No, you're right. And then climate change gets worse and we're much worse off. But Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, incredible information. Glad you took some time for us. Look forward to having you get back again real soon.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. All the best to you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Here at The Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor, and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.